Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Cynthia from the Atlantic Group in Manhattan.
Hi, everybody. My name is Cynthia, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 17, 1994. My sponsor's name is Arisa. I'm sure you'll hear me refer to her a few times. And my home group is the Atlantic Group in New York City. We meet 7 nights a week. Tuesday night is our main meeting. And I met some of the ladies when they came to my Jersey home group that I was booking speakers for. We're called Design for Living, and it's a big book study. We meet Sunday nights in Neptune. Wednesday is our speaker meeting in Asbury Park. And that is where I reside, and it's quite a distance from here, and it's probably equally as long to get to my home group on Tuesday night, so I'll be back in the car tomorrow. And I noticed this morning on my my odometer, I hit 10,000 this morning. I was psyched. But I just got my car, actually, St. Patrick's Day, so not so happy about that. Those miles are expensive. But whatever it takes, actually. It really, whatever it takes, whatever is asked. I learned very on to say yes. I just looked down. I found this ring today in my dad's room. My dad passed away in November, and I was wondering, I haven't seen that ring on him in a long time. I don't even know what it's made of, but I wondered what happened to it, and I just discovered it today. So I feel very, like, blessed that I've had such, you know, an amazing, awkward, whatever life, that I was able to be reunited with my parents later on in recovery, due to, you know, my own issues when I was younger. Because I don't know if any of you are like how I was when I was young, before I even started drinking. I might as well just had a drink. I found fault in everything that you were doing, everything you were saying. I always thought I was cooler than you, and I carried that way into my sobriety as well. You know, like, everybody was doing everything wrong. Whatever it was, I was so discontent wherever I went and whoever I was with. And I don't know about you, but even today, sometimes I feel like I want to be somewhere else. Like, I could be on a beautiful, you know, beach somewhere, yet my head is spinning about, you know, how much more fun I'd be having in Tahiti or, you know, wherever else. Like, wherever I am is just not good enough. And what that is untreated alcoholism. And I wake up with untreated alcoholism every day, and I'm going to tell you about, like, what I do on a daily basis to make sure that I don't stay miserable and discontented throughout the course of the day. Because if I stay like that, I'm sure to drink. And I'm not just saying that because I've experienced. I don't, you know, when I really stopped drinking for my last time, my last hangover, I never picked up alcohol again. So I'm not an in-and-out person. I came to AA a little further on into recovery because I wanted to do whatever it took not to be like you guys. Because to me, I felt like you guys were all losers. You were men, you know, back in the 90s. I didn't know there was women here. And, you know, yet you destroyed your lives and you had nothing going on. Why would I want to hang out with you? What do you got for me? But eventually I did attend my first meeting. So when I had three older sisters, and they were grouped together, close in age, they're very cool, and I wanted to be like them, but I was too young and they didn't want me around. It was, you know, a big age difference, and so I was kind of cast aside with my little brother, and I was so resentful at him for as long as memory takes me back. If I ever came close to feeling the word hate, it was towards my brother. He stole the thunder when he came, and he had some health issues, so there were some scares, so he got extra attention, and that's the way it went. But when I saw my sisters drinking together in the house and they were going out clubbing or to the bars or whatever, I just wanted to aspire to be just like them. And when I started drinking, you know, that whole line in Bill's story, I had arrived. Like, I really felt like this was going to be my ticket into, you know, sisterhood. And it wasn't. It didn't make a difference what I was doing. I could have, you know, hit the lottery of Mega Millions, but they didn't want to hang out with me. I was just not old enough. But drinking really worked back then. You know, it made me feel more at ease. I mean, I wouldn't let anybody know how uncomfortable I was feeling inside. Like I said, I was cool, you know, to the core in my own head. But alcohol really was that social lubricant. And I think, you know, the best part of that back in seventh, eighth grade was that it gave me the courage to start kissing boys. I started that whole boy thing earlier than other people, and I just, like, that was my outlet, you know, drinking boys. But eventually, not you, boy, get out of here. But eventually, it really started getting me into trouble, and not just the drinking, the boys. But I started bartending because I couldn't hold a job, and I was bartending in a town called Hoboken. It's right outside of Manhattan, lots of bars. You know, you don't need to drive, although I felt like liberty to drive everywhere, and I'm Cynthia and I could just double park in front of your establishment. Like, that's how I was back then. And but I was bartending around town trying to hold on to jobs. The last job that I had there, I worked there for 19 years, and that was, I never could imagine life without bartending. I started there like 1990 or whatever. I got sober in 94. And I think I worked out there till 2009. Like, that's how afraid and insecure I was to get out there in the real world. And it took getting fired from that job, and it was not a good scene. So, and I definitely will tell you about that because it has a lot to do with my ninth step. But one of the good things that did come out of those years back then is that because it was a yuppie town, and I felt so insecure, and I pushed myself to go to college, and I made my husband, my victim or prisoner, I made him go to college too, you know, because we weren't going to be, you know, we needed to be like the Joneses, which made no sense. But anyway, the good thing about going to school, and it is good to get an education, obviously, but is that I got sober at Rutgers. There was some sort of weird outbreak epidemic of tuberculosis, and I was sick all the time, and the doctor that I always went to for antibiotics sent me to get a TB test. My arm blew up. They took the x-rays. Thank God it wasn't in my lungs, but I was exposed to TB and had to go on medication for 6 months. And during those 6 months, you absolutely can't take a drop of alcohol. It's just, at least, I don't think there was internet, or I really was savvy with internet yet, but basically they were telling me that I could blow out my liver and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So this was in October of, I think that was 92, and I was telling her, I'll take it January 1st. And she said, no, you start taking this medicine today. And I said, I can't, you know, January 1st. And she was like, no, you don't understand. It's in your system. We don't want it to go into your lungs. We have to get this tuberculosis, you know, out of you. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I have Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. Like, I'm being sarcastic with this doctor who was clearly trying to help me. And she said, I'm making an appointment for you to go upstairs and talk to the drug and alcohol counselor. And I was like, why? Like, I just totally didn't get it. But I reluctantly started that medication. I started seeing that drug and alcohol counselor. I have no idea why I continued with that. And then they put me in a student group. Now, at that time, I think I was maybe 25 years old, so I was much older than the students on campus and a lot older than the students in the group. And, you know, I really white-knuckled during those 5.5 months. I couldn't even make it 6 months. I made up some lie to my husband when we were on vacation, and I said I didn't need to take it anymore. But when I started drinking again, I was vicious. Like, and I remember I said this one time, and I don't know what a truck driver drinks like, but I felt like I was drinking like a truck driver. Like, I just could not stop. It was like never before. You know, that I could not show up for anything. And I was pretty, you know, pretty scarce in the brain before that. But now, it was off the charts. And I still kept going to see the counselor and the student group. And the student group was on Monday. And I just could not make it back to Monday without having a drink all week. And it was going really well to like Wednesday, Thursday, but by the weekend it was off, you know, and I would come back in there and be like all weepy and felt like, you know, oh, life sucks, everything sucks. And then, you know, like the kids in this group were just trying to help me. And I literally said this to them once. I said, "You don't even know what it's like to dance on top of a bar. What do you know about life?" And these like 19 or 20 year olds are looking at me like, "What is wrong with this lady?" But I truly felt that way, you know, like, what do you know about life? You know, but this is what happened. I hadn't drank for like a few months, and then I was on a cruise. Have not been on a cruise since 1994, but I was with my husband, and we were hanging out with some couples. It was St. Patrick's Day, and he wanted to enter some beer drinking contests, and I was like, "Yeah, go." And he comes back like all sulky, and he said, "They're for couples only." And I was like, "Well, sign us up." And he said, "Well, you can't drink anymore." And I was like, "Ah, we're out to sea, you know, it's whatever." And it's St. Patrick's Day, I'm Irish. So he signs us up, and they hand out the beers, and thank you, God. I was a heavy beer drinker, but I did not drink beer out of a can, nor did I ever drink beer warm. But I was handed a warm can of beer, and, you know, they did the whistle or whatever for the contest to start, and I put the beer to my lips, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't drink. I couldn't drink it. And I looked at Mike, and he finished his beer, and he looked at me, and he was like, "What?" You're like, "Now what?" You know, and I felt like lower than scum, because here I am. I can't even do this for my husband. Like, I can't even just have one beer drank quickly for him. Like, life sucks. And that night, and I was always like very money conscious, and we were on this cruise, which was like a dump ship compared to all these big, beautiful cruise lines, you know, these Royal Caribbean cruises going by. And and we're stuck on this really crappy cruise with, you know, crap food, and you hear the music and you could see the people dancing across the way. And like, I was, you know, I felt like Mike is probably thinking like, "Why did I marry her?" And I'm thinking like, "Why did he marry me? And if I jumped off the back of this ship, who would miss me? I would just be doing everybody a favor. You know, I cheated on Mike numerous times. You know, I could set him free to have a normal life. You know, they wouldn't have to make excuses up for me at the restaurant. I didn't have any relationship with my family, and I just felt like crap. And I really just felt like, you know, what's the point of living?" And, you know, I so identify in Bill's story when he talks about the guys jumping after the stock market crash. And he's like, "You know, those guys are pussies. I'm going back to the bar." And like, I felt like that, you know, like I couldn't even jump to like end it all. Like, I was such a pussy that I couldn't even do that. So, you know, the trip ended. I went back home, and then in my student group showed up the woman who served me my last drink at the bar, back at Halloween time. And, she bartended where my husband DJ'd, and I thought she was showing up at my student group to find out my secrets or something. But the truth was, she went to Rutgers and she needed to get sober, and her life was in the crapper too. And so after we talked after the group, she invited me to go to the Hoboken Friday night meeting. And I was like, "You don't want to go to AA. It's full of losers. You know, this is good enough." And she was like, "Well, would you take the night off?" And I did. And, you know, I walked in and it looked like this, you know. There were probably, you know, top heavy men, not top heavy, but like there was probably 80% men and 20% women. But still, like, it wasn't what I was thinking AA was. And, I felt so comfortable. I went back the next morning to the 9 a.m. meeting, and I have to tell you, like, life changed, you know. things started changing for me a few months later. Mike and I went to marriage counseling. We were able to divorce amicably. We're still friends today. He was at my house the other night. This is back in 1994, you know, and we're still friends. Like, it's a miracle. I had friends, at least, so-called friends, fair-weather friends or whatever, because I was not a friend. I didn't know what it was like to be a friend, even though I was not drinking, going to meetings. But this is what happened. After not drinking and going to meetings for 4.5 years, and you probably heard the story from other speakers, I was ready to kill somebody. I don't know who that person would have been that night. I was at an AA dance down the Jersey Shore. We had, a sober house that we were all staying at, and I was so miserable, and I was, like, ready to combust. And somebody, I had somebody's ear, and I'm chewing his ear off about my boyfriend and blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me stone cold and said, "What step are you working on?" And I was like, oh, my God. I was flabbergasted, but something intervened. Something came in. And I said to him, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he was like, you are sober for how long? Like I said, 4.5 years. And I got honest with him. And he was like, oh, man, and honestly, we started, he showed me pages in the book, like some facts. And he's like, this is eventually going to happen if you don't do this work. And I was like, oh, my God, what do I do? He asked his sponsor if he could sponsor me. His sponsor couldn't understand why there weren't any other women that could do it. I'm sure there were, but I wasn't asking anybody. I'm not going to ask a woman for help. But the one thing that he did was that following Tuesday night, he urged me to take off, and we went into New York. And he brought me to the Atlanta group. I started going to that meeting, and then a couple weeks later, this guy who had 2.5 years sobriety, who I thought had some kind of message here, he started drinking. And he didn't drink like how I drank. He drank like ends up in the hospital. I just end up, like peeing in somebody's alleyway, sleeping with somebody I'd never met before, while my, husband's out, with the search party looking for me. That's how I drank. This guy is strapped to a gurney. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I went back across the river to that meeting, and Arisa came over to me, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, that young kid that brought me here, he's drinking again." And she was like, "Yeah." I was like, "Hello, I said he's drinking again." And she was like, "Yeah, that's what alcoholics do. We drink again." She said, "We drink." I was like, wait a minute. Like, I was so baffled. I'm like, I don't understand. I could drink again? Like, something wasn't. And she said, "Cynthia, this is what happens to people that are not doing what needs to be done in Alcoholics Anonymous. They drink again." And what she was saying was similar to what Mike was just saying to me, those few weeks leading up to his relapse. So the first time in my life, I asked a woman for help. I said, "Can you help me?" And Arisa says to me, which I'm sure your sponsors asked you something similar, "Are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety?" I don't know what any lengths is, right? How would I ever know what that meant? So I said yes, because I lie, and I tell you what you want to hear. So I said yes. Well, any lengths, wow. That was a change. She lived in New York. I had to get on a bus, like, almost every day and read with Arisa. She took me through the book. She started me on my step work. Any lengths meant now that for the first time in my life, probably since communion in second grade, I got on my knees and I started praying. I didn't believe in anything. I thought it was all fiction and, for losers or, that wrote these books to keep, their society in order, centuries ago. That's what I thought that God was. I soon come to find out that that's not what we're talking about in here. When we're talking about God and having an experience with God, it could be an all-encompassing power source that could be very personal and your very own. It doesn't have to do with anybody else in here. If you belong to a religious denomination, that's great too. They talk the same language there. Okay, fine. But all I need to do is have my own personal language with my higher power. I didn't quite understand that for quite some time, but what was going to happen was that Arisa was going to, you know, hold my hand through the rest of the steps so I could see how that power source gets used, gets tapped into, and how it shows up even when I don't even ask for it sometimes. So, you know, I had a little momentum going after my fourth and fifth step, and that was eye-opening, you know, to really have someone else pointing out your character defects, to have someone else help you to see where those areas in my life, I was the one causing the ruckus, causing the confusion, causing the drama, basically. I pretended I wasn't the drama queen, but if you really looked at the underlying power behind all of the resentments and the chaos, it was sourced straight from me. But it took a really good sponsor to get me to see that. You know, if I had somebody different, I may not be alive today. And not that I'm putting Arisa as a human being on some weird pedestal, but it was what I needed at the time. So I had a little momentum and I started my, my amends, and now I'm probably like a 5.5 years sober. And one of the first amends that I made was going to be to a woman in the program. I used her utterly. I was living with my boyfriend and I made up all excuses that I was with Kelly while I was fooling around with some guy from Brooklyn. And I really put her in a really crappy position. You know, it was pretty bad, you know, and she didn't want to see me. And I was like, wow, this is somebody in AA and this is how it's going to go. What's the point? But the point was that Arisa said, that's all right. You know, I could check off that index card. If she comes around down the road, at least I have the material to talk to her. So as my amends kept going, and this was another thing too, when I was going to make amends to certain people, like my ex-husband, my family members, some personal friends, I had my script written out. I had outlines, and I asked them if they would mind if I, because in the beginning, I was scared, you know, like, I really wanted to do this because I didn't want to end up like Mike. Mike, the guy who brought me to the Atlanta group, is dead. He eventually died of drinking. That really was an eye-opener to me, because I coasted for those 4.5 years. So, flew down to Florida, made amends to Mike, my ex-husband, his second wife at the time, you know, my family. I never, ever had a relationship with my parents, ever in my life. Never had a conversation with them, nothing. So a couple years prior, my dad had a stroke, and I don't know where this came in me, because I've never been a very nice person, but some weird Florence Nightingale kind of instinct came to me when he had his stroke, and I wanted to be with him in the hospital, and I was showing up every day, first time ever I'm showing up for anybody. And then when he went to the rehabilitation center, I was showing up there. They kind of bent the hours because I worked at nighttime. They let me come during the day, so I was able to hang out with him during his, like we cooked meatloaf, you know, like those weird classes where you put like, you know, pegs and holes and whatever. They let me stick around for that, and I was able to start a relationship with my dad. So now when I was going to make amends to him and being accountable to what a piece of dirt I was to the whole family for those many years, you know, he basically said to me, you know, we're even, we're good, our scorecards, you know, are at zero, basically, because I did show up for him like he never saw a daughter show up for him. And that is the most meaningful, I believe, most meaningful amends, because, well, all right, before I tell you that, so now I'm trudging. Arisa leaves New York and moves to Boston. She starts having a family, screaming kids in the background. I don't like to talk and hear kids. And the calls become less and less. I moved down the Jersey Shore. I have this big whole new circle of victims and whatever, because now I am self-will run riot. And the boy issue that I had way back in, you know, fourth grade and sixth grade and seventh and 12th and et cetera was coming back in full force. And I was like really causing a lot of situations, you know, where I moved to. And it started catching up to me. And I was, one night it really imploded and I was really nervous. I wrote Arisa a very lengthy email and I told her everything from start to finish. Like I logged on, you know, like I took inventory on everything and I sent it to her and she calls me at 6 a.m. She's an early riser and we went over my inventory and she sent me to another fellowship for a little while. And that was a big eye opener. And, it was kind of scary walking into a new type of meeting, especially I didn't know much, but once I got their textbook, wow, like their big book, you know, I identified so quickly, more so than it took me so long to identify as an alcoholic all those years. While in that fellowship, I identified from the first opening line of the meeting. And it was kind of scary, but I went through that program for a little while. Went back to my regular meetings because they were on Tuesday nights too. So went back, now growing up again in AA, you know, keep trudging, making amends. Well, in 2009, and there was a couple of things that I share now that I never shared before. I started sharing this a couple of years ago only because it took me a long time to really be okay with what I did in my past. But this is what happened. In 2009, again, you know, Arisa, busy up in Boston raising her kids. I'm down here. I'm still working at that restaurant and new management came in and, you know, a big group of us gets fired. I call Arisa and she says, the shenanigans that you told me about many years ago, like 10 years ago, that was still going on. I was like, well, you know, it was like a group effort, Arisa, like I'm a team player. And she flew down from Boston and said, meet me in New York. We went up, I met her, and I had to be honest with her and tell her, you know, I was a thief. You know, I stole from my employer. I was stealing from him for all those years. And, you know, she said, you're so close to a drink, it scares me that you don't even see it. And she said, you need to get a sponsor that you could be eyeball to eyeball with down here. And I turned to another woman down that lives down by me, and I told her the truth of what happened. She was like the only person I also confided in, and I was afraid because she knows all my friends down the Jersey Shore. I didn't want anybody to know, and I was embarrassed. I was mortified. And she said, yeah, I could help you. So we started the work. Now, months later, I contact that former employer, and his wife had brain cancer. And the brain cancer came back. When I called him that day, he knew I was trying to get in touch with him, kind of half-assed over the years. And he answers the phone. I said, hey, you know, Dave, you remember me, Cynthia, blah, blah. And he said, Cynthia, Anna's brain cancer came back. I don't care about your AA crap. Leave me alone. And he hung up. And I was like, oh, my gosh. But to me, I'm thinking, yeah, you know, like, I don't have to face him. I don't have to say anything, you know. Like, so anyway, went back to my sponsor down there, and I said, you know, I made that attempt, you know. And so we kind of went over, you know, just kind of put that to the side and kept trudging through the rest of my amends because I had, I don't know, like 40 at the time. But now, a little while later, her and I part ways. I end up back with Arisa. And here's the other, like, thing that I share about now from the podium because it could help somebody. I'm going to be 20 years sober. I knew I was going to run for overall chair for my home group the following year, which is a big deal. It's a lot of work. I was an assistant chairperson the prior year, and it would mean a lot to me. And but something that meant a little more to me was the tall salt and pepper guy dressed really nice in the coffee room. He became something that I wanted, and there comes back, old Cynthia back in action. Because Cynthia doesn't care that this guy says, well, I have 4.5 months. Well, he didn't tell me that at first, but the guy has 4.5 months. He's like in his mid-50s. He's been drinking all of these years. Perhaps, you know, I should get to know this person and find out he's probably not the healthiest nut in the toolbox, and I should probably stay far away from him. Never mind that he only has 4.5 years, 4.5 months, and, you know, what am I doing? But nope, I, you know, don't listen to the warnings, you know, I failed to heed, and I do what I do best, and now I'm keeping secrets from everybody. I can't let my friends know, I'm mortified. I can't let my sponsor know, I'm lying. I can't let anybody know because I'm going to run for overall chair. So there's something very important to me. They can't know. My home group has like 500 members at it, you know, so I'm living a big secret. Sure enough, the red flags come out one day in December, and I pulled the plug on it, and I was like, lose my number. Goodbye. Because I got really scared. You know, I was getting the year ready, you know, because I had won the election and it was like a lot of work. And I was just like, you know what, I can't do this. Bye. Well, not even thinking that perhaps this man has some feelings. Didn't care. I go out to the convention, the Roundup or Woodstock out in Vegas every December. And I'm out there and I have some inventory that I haven't talked to Risa about, but she was sick. She didn't come. So now I'm like self-will. I was actually, you know, kind of ducking a guy out there that I was, you know, kind of seeing on and off. And I'm crazy, Cynthia. And I get a call from somebody back in New York, and he says, that guy, the newcomer, is in the hospital. We don't know what's going to happen. He basically was found almost dead in his apartment from drinking. And I was like, oh my gosh. I had a sober sister there, grabbed her. We went back into our hotel room, and I just got down on my knees and I prayed to God and I begged God, like, please, please remove this from me. This crazy, this, you know, self-will, whatever I want, you know, the men thing, take it away. I don't play this game right. Just please take it away, God. That day in the hotel room back in 2015, I think that was, or no, 2014, God took it away and never came back. He never gave it back, and I don't know what happened. It was like I had a lobotomy or something. Something that, like, I nursed for all of those years since I was little was just poof, removed. It's no longer a luxury or a necessity. It's like nothing. And, you know, I have to say, since all of that happened, I've never been so present for my family, sponsees, and my career. You know, I'm a real estate agent, which, you know, sometimes I feel like any monkey could do it, but then sometimes I'm like, I can't even handle the little bit of business that I have. I'm ready to rip my hair out. But the thing is, like, I am so present today because of that area of my life is gone. Now, I don't know, but now get back on track. I do that year out. Now it's, I'm in my 20th year. Oh, and by the way, Arisa, I tell Arisa about the newcomer. Arisa over the phone, she doesn't bother flying down in New York anymore. She says, get yourself a new sponsor. I'm done. You know, like, I'm killing you. And and that was Christmas Eve, right before the year I was going to start chairing. And I'm like, how dare she do this to me? I'm like the overall chair of the Atlanta group. Like, that really means something to anybody. And like, but in my head, I'm like, how can she do this to me? And now I'm calling up some of my girlfriends, and I'm like, you know, blah, you know, to them about what happened. And both of these girls said to me, why don't you ask Bonnie to sponsor you? And I'm like, Bonnie? Why would I ask Bonnie to sponsor me? I'm like, we don't like each other. And they're like, yeah, maybe that's why you should ask Bonnie to sponsor you. And I was like, oh, God. So Christmas Day, I call up Bonnie, and I'm like, I'm in a pickle, Bonnie. I need help. Do you have room? Can you take on another sponsee? And she was like, yeah, conditionally. You want to hear the conditions? And she told me her conditions and how she sponsors women, and I said yes, because I was nervous. I didn't want to go into that role that I had, sponsorless, and I burned through sponsors, you know, and I was kind of scared of her. And so it went. I'm in my 20th year. That was the year that two things went on. My mom, my parents split up after 49 years of marriage. My dad moves in with me. Like I said, we were not like buddies, chummy or anything, but you know, him and my brother had a big blowout fight at the house. My brother, 3 years younger than me, and he was still crashing at my parents' house. And my father said, if Bobby's not out by whatever date, I'm moving out. And he's telling me this while he's all bloodied up in an emergency room. And I was like, where would you go, Dad? And he's like, I'll move in with you. And I'm like, okay. So, which he did at 13 years ago, 14. And but then a few years later, not even, like a year later, my mom ends up having a stroke. And we put her into a senior building down by us in Asbury Park because my dad feels very loyal to her. And he's taking care of her because Bobby's kind of like out of the picture, my brother. And so now I'm having a relationship with my parents for the first time. Now, eventually my mom gets worse and we have to put her into a nursing home. Now I'm showing up there every single day and it's like blowing me away. My sisters can't even believe it. My sisters are like, my mother's, they remember my mom pre-stroke. I see my mom now post-stroke. It's almost like she had a lobotomy too, you know, like she's kind of like childlike. So I'm finding her to be very tender and loving and not like what she was in the past. So now I have this ability to tolerate her. So I'm there every day. I'm doing things, brushing her hair. Like I'm kind of like her advocate there. And, you know, and I'm with my dad every morning having coffee. You know, we watch the news together. I mean, like, my life is really cool. You know, I'm, like, probably late 40s now at this point, because I'm 52 now, so it's, like, 4 years ago. And so that year, I decided, you know what? I'm going to make my amends to my mom. 20 years sober, why not? You know, it's about time, right? So I talked to Bonnie, and I had my script, and I sat on my mother's bed, and she knew that I never did it because, you know, she went to Al-Anon. And any time I brought a new boyfriend home from AA, you know, which was quite often, you know, she would say, yeah, you know, she's the queen of AA, but she's never made any amends to her family members. And, you know, I'd be like, shut that H up, Ma, you know, like all pissed off. Come on, let's go, honey, you know, and like go stomping out of the house, you know, because she was only telling them the truth. But so here I was, you know, I was ready to make my amends and to own up to the crap that I've, you know, gotten away with or thought I was and, you know, really wanted to be accountable to her, gave her an opportunity to talk. And, you know, she said, I loved all of you kids the same. Like, I don't know why you had such a problem not believing that I loved you, you know, and I don't know. I don't know why I just put up that wall, but I did. And so that summer, I was speaking at a meeting in Hoboken, that Saturday morning meeting, and I was like, and that's where, you know, I worked and my old boss lived, and I was like, you know what, Anna had died, Dave's wife, my old boss's wife. I saw him at the funeral, I paid my respects, we attended a wedding, this is someone's wedding, so we've been in the same room a couple times, so I said, ah, what the heck, and I text him, and I said, hi, Dave, I'm in town. Do you think maybe we can meet for coffee? But like, as soon as I hit send, the phone rang and it was him. And he was like, I would love to meet you. Let's have lunch. And I'm like, okay. So now I have like an hour before I have to meet him and I'm like melting. I'm so scared. So I called Bonnie, my current sponsor. She wasn't there. I called up Arisa up in Boston. She wasn't there. I called up Mary Beth, my sponsor down the shore, you know, from a few years prior, who knew what was going on, and she answered. And, you know, she knew about my inventory because I had done my 4-step with her years ago. And, you know, we talked about the amends to him, and, you know, we read from the 12 and 12. We read from the big book. And we prayed together, and she said, you're good to go. Like, you know, go in love. Do God's work. Do AA work. And I walked into that restaurant. My knees were shaking. I had to keep talking to God. sat at the table, and he's giving me small talk about his kids, and then he's like, so Cynthia, how much money did you steal from me? And I was like, oh my God, I am so scared. And I started crying so bad, and he's like, if you don't stop crying, I'm walking out of here. And I'm like, oh my God, no, I can't blow this opportunity, you know? So I said an amount, and his jaw dropped, and then he put his head in his hands for like, seemed like eternity, but like a minute. And he looks at me, he's like, how did you do that? And I said, Dave, I worked for you for 19 years. Like, it was a combination of me not being a good employee, you know, like chasing business away, I'm sure. And, you know, it's easy to do, Dave. And, you know, so we had a little conversation about what I could do to make it right. Technically, he doesn't want the money back. The guy's like a billionaire, but still, I'm doing what I can and however he tells me to do it. And it's crazy that Dave and I are friends today. We talk all the time. You know, he's a little socially awkward. He's like a fish out of water. I think he was very reliant on Anna for a lot of his socializing. So, you know, he's never heard us talk. Like, he doesn't know anybody in AA, and he's not an alcoholic. So I think, you know, hearing someone talk from their heart, you know, makes him feel comfortable. And we have great conversations. And so now that was 4 years ago. Just to bring up to date with my life today, not this past January, but the January before, January 13th on a Friday, after a month in ICU and on being intubated, I lost my mom. And that really, really sucked. And I don't know if you guys feel like this, but I always felt like my parents were always going to be around. You know, I just never thought that there was going to be a day that I was going to lose them. They were such, you know, and they weren't bad people, but like, I can honestly say that last month, you know, like, I just wanted to tell my mother I loved her a million times a day, and I never said it before in my life. I don't know if it's Irish, I don't know if it's Catholic or Irish Catholic together, or and the German mixed in, but we never said we loved each other. We never showed affection. We never touched, kissed, nothing. Probably why I was looking for all that on the outside, but come to think of it. But anyway, that's just how I was grown up, how we grew up. But like, I just didn't want to let my mother go. And I was a basket case, boy. I was a basket case. One thing I always wondered about was, you know, over the years, like, what's my brother going to do? You know, and my brother showed up at the wake up in North Jersey, and Arisa happened to come down from Boston, thank God. He was drunk. My brother's been using for his whole life. He caused a scene, left early, and then the next morning for the burial, he didn't show up. And I don't even know if I really noticed during the day, but and it was a Tuesday, and it was pouring rain out. It was such a crappy day. And I was 7 miles from the Lincoln Tunnel, and I so badly wanted to go and be with my home group. But I had my dad with me, and you know, I had to bring him back down the shore after the repast. And so we went home, and I sat in my recliner, and I dozed off. And then all of a sudden, something woke me up, and I said, call my brother. Now, I always had a few numbers for my brother. I never called him, and I don't know what number would have been his, but whatever number I chose, I called him. And I was like, Bob, where are you? I'm home. Well, where were you this morning? And because of his drinking for so long, he kind of stuttered, you know, and he's like, Sin. And he's trying to tell me he couldn't handle it. And I got a little pissy with him, you know, like, couldn't handle it. Like, how about watching what we just watched? And I kind of described the last, like, half hour, which was pretty grueling. I'm surprised he didn't hang up on me. But I guess old Cynthia hello returned, but anyway, then I was like, you know what? I said, Bob, can you do me a favor? I said, if I send a couple of guys over, can they take you to a detox? And he was like, I don't need that, you know. And he's trying to tell me, you know, he's going to the gym and eating right and all this crazy stuff. And And I said, I don't know, Bob. I said, I got this weird feeling that I'm never going to talk to you again. I said, and you know what? I really owe you an apology. I could have helped you. I could have been a better sister. I could have hooked you up with other people. I was just so resentful at you. And, you know, I basically told him that, you know, because of me, I put the wedge in our relationship. And, you know, I was doing my best attempt to make an amends off the cuff. And I said to him, is there anything that maybe you want to tell me about? Maybe I left out. And one thing he says, which kind of freaked me out, he said, yeah, why did you try and kill me? And I was like, I did? You know, because I was a blackout drinker. And he was like, yeah, you always used to try and kill me with knives. And I do kind of remember a knife situation, but I think my memory says that he had the knives. But my mother worked above the police station, and the cops were at the house all the time, and it was very humiliating to us. Phones were ripped out of the wall often. And I don't know really what he meant. And I said, Bob, I really wish that I came to you sooner, so maybe we could have talked about this sooner. And, you know, I said, but at this point, I can't do anything about what happened 30 years ago or 40 years ago. I said, but I just want you to know that I'm not going to call you again, but I want you to know that you could call me if you want to get help, and I'll send the troops for you. And he was like, yeah, okay. And we hung up. And I knew it. You know, my dad died in November, this past November, car wreck, horrible, horrible. He lived 17 days in ICU, and it was just horrible. Like, last year was not very pleasant. It really sucked for me. But then my brother died. I got the call. The cops came to my house to tell me. And he drank himself to death. We went up there. We saw where he lived. It was horrible. The guys didn't want us going in. I was with my sisters, the husbands, and one of my ex-boyfriends went in. And they came out. They're like, yeah, you girls don't have to see it. But then a couple minutes later, I'm like, no, I want to see it. Because I'm no different than my brother. And I wanted to see what it looked like up there. And it smelled really bad. There was bugs. It was like a hoarder. I don't think he flushed his toilet in a year. I don't think his shower was used in a year. The landlord said once my mother died, he just was a recluse. And hundreds of bottles. You know, he literally drank himself to death. And I needed to see that, because if I think that I'm going to drink, you know, like that girl on the ship, you know, having a Coors Light, you know, the girl back in Hoboken, I'm not going to drink like that again. I know it. I know it. I have a very powerful disease, and I know that because it twists my head up so crazy and makes me think all these other weird things. So what I need to do today, and this is what I do, in the morning I wake up and I thank God for this awesome disease that I have, because if it wasn't for alcoholism, I wouldn't know a God. I would have no idea of what God is, or what my God is, I should say. I wouldn't know what to do with situations in life if I was just a regular person, or if I, you know, whatever, had blood clots or something. You know, like, this is, for me, this disease is terrific outside of drinking. You know, I say my third and seventh step prayer, man-made, and then I have a conversation with God, and I think about the day ahead, because that's what the book tells me to do. I have a purposeful pause on my phone at 2 o'clock. It goes off every day, because then I do my nightly review for the first time each day at 2 o'clock, because I'm still Cynthia, and I don't want the old Cynthia to show up in my affairs. So at 2 o'clock, if I've done something that I need to make a quick, you know, change in behavior, or talk to somebody about, or make amends, then I could do it. At 24 years sober, I try and make a meeting almost every single day, because why not? I do have a full life. Last night after our big book meeting, you know, in the summertime on Sunday nights, there's a band that plays, and, you know, I go out and we dance to, you know, a cover band till 10:30 at night. Like, my life has not changed. I Bruce Springsteen is like, I was always, you know, my thing, and 350 concerts. I've never been to one drunk. I never had a drink, even when I was drinking at a concert. Like, I've chased him all over the world. You know, like, anything that I've wanted to do in the past 24 years, I've done. You know, and I think it's because since I finally got this, and I have to say, when I finally got this, 20 years sober, I finally got this. Like, I don't want to alter, I don't want to vary, I don't want to skimp, I don't want, I mean, things happen. Maybe this week I'll only make 3 meetings, who the heck knows? But I do make an attempt every day to get to a meeting. I check in with my sponsor, I send her emails of my inventory. I do, like I said, I do my nightly review. I have girls that email, that have the app on their phone, and they send me their inventory. I don't delete it. I read it. If there's something I need to talk to them about, we go over it. I sponsor 5 girls now. Almost every single one calls me every single day. You know, Arisa doesn't want me calling her every day. She sponsors like 25 women. But, you know, if I need to call her, I make sure she knows I need to talk to you. My girls, I want them to call me because I want to know what's going on in their lives, because I know how I was at 2 years, at 4 years, and at 9 years, and I have a newcomer. But I know what I was doing during those years, and I was not checking in with Arisa. I was not being honest with her, you know. So for me, you know, that's a big important aspect, tool in the toolbox. And you know what, just showing up, I double dip at 2 home groups, but, you know, I'm there every week, same spot. I get there early, 4:30 for a 7 o'clock meeting tomorrow, 6 o'clock for a 7 o'clock meeting on Sunday. Us girls, we look around the room for other women that we don't know their name. We go and introduce themselves, make small talk. That's what we do Sunday night and Tuesday night. You know, I don't know if you guys have that here, but we make sure that everybody is welcome and everybody is acknowledged. And if I see a guy sitting by himself or kind of feeling, you know, whatever, I make sure one of my guy friends are over there introducing themselves, that so no one slips through the cracks. And you know what? That's just what I do to stay sober today. And, you know, I look forward to seeing some of you guys, hopefully, at the Jersey Shore Roundup that we have in November in Long Branch. If you've never been, please come. You know, Google Jersey Shore Roundup. We have great speakers, you know, flown in from around, you know, maybe you've heard them, speaker tapes, but it's a great thing to do. And I just love hanging out with you guys. So thank you so much for my sobriety.